Welcome back to another episode of Better Than I Found It, the podcast All Things College Golf. You're listening to Mike McGraw, the men's golf coach at Baylor University. Today's guest on Better Than I Found It is Sean Martin, who works for the PGA Tour. He's the lead editorial for the PGA Tour. He does a fantastic job as a young journalist covering the game of golf. He's been covering golf for basically 18 years. He started with college golf with Golf Week magazine and then eventually got over to the PGA Tour. Sean is not only a terrific journalist, he does a great job of building relationships. You'll hear about that. He, just a week or so ago, had a text thread on the internet about Scottie Scheffler, and he had some observations that I think were amazing, and I've shared that with my golf team. I think you'll love hearing about it as well. Sean Martin, one of the great young journalists today in the world of golf. Enjoy the listening. All right, Better Than I Found It listeners, join me in welcoming Sean Martin to the podcast today. Sean, so nice to have you. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I'm the second most famous Cal Poly alum you've had on after Courtney Roberts, so I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, Courtney, she was great. I always loved Courtney. She's fantastic in her days at Oklahoma State when I got to know her. And actually, when I was the assistant coach at Oklahoma State, we were a combined program, and I actually recruited her at Oak Tree in Edmond. So I saw her play when she was a 16-year-old, and she's great. But you are the second most famous Cal Poly golf or golf personality for sure.
I've been impressed with the coaches we've been able to get with between Phil Rowe and then Courtney on the women's side. I've been very happy with the athletic department. They definitely, I think, outpunched their weight in getting those two coaches in recently.
Well, I think they're both great. Phil obviously was a great player as well, and he's a terrific coach, and I think he's going to do great things there. So we got the Cal Poly kind of plug in there. You're a 2004 graduate, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Well, I met you just shortly thereafter. It wasn't long when I became the head coach at Oklahoma State. You kind of got into the college golf world, that's golf journalism world, if you will. But before we go there, I'm going to ask lead, editorial PGA Tour. That's a title, but I don't understand it. Help me out with it. Let's go. Give me a job description. Who are you?
Sure. Basically, let's say the head editor of the head editor of PJTour.com. So I manage the writing team of the writers who contribute to PJTour.com. We have three full-timers, Kevin Price, who I think a lot of people who follow the Korn Ferry Tour and college golf probably know very well, a guy who does a great job covering the up-and-comers. Cameron Morfitt, an extremely experienced journalist that came to us after years at Sports Illustrated. And then we've just hired a new guy, Paul Hadawanik, from the Minnesota area, an experienced journalist in his few years out of college and a golf nut. He actually starts next week, so we're excited to bring him to the fold. And then also manage a team of freelancers who help cover, you know, all the events that we have, because we have five tours playing golf about 45 weeks a year. So it's a lot to cover. So we have to spread ourselves pretty wide to try to bring all of that to people. And so my main job is writing myself as well, going to events, covering them, and then also managing that team and trying to do the best coverage we can for our fans.
That's amazing. You know, I must confess I harbor and have a deep kind of desire or belief that I could have been a golf journalist. I was a sports editor in the high school paper when I was in Ponca City, Oklahoma as a kid. I wrote a junior golf column for the Edmond Evening Sun for 15 years. And all the high school.
Yeah. We may have crossed paths at Kicking Bird at one point before 2006, for all we know.
Well, when were you at Kicking Bird?
I would come once a summer for about 1 week per summer to visit my aunt and uncle in Edmond, probably from the time I was high school. So, you know, mid 90s to up until probably around college. So early 2000s.
Okay. I left Edmond in June 1st of 97. So I might have run across you at Kicking Bird. Yeah, I spent the better part of every day for 19 years at Kicking Bird. It was like that was my home away from home. I didn't have a home. I had an apartment only because you can't sleep at the golf course. They wouldn't allow it.
All I remember is it was very often U.S. Amateur Week when I'd visit my aunt and uncle. And I remember you might remember this one, but I remember watching the J.J. Henry Joel Crivel first round match from the 1998 U.S. Amateur at Oak Hill.
Wow. Well, you do have a good memory. That's
I
good.
don't know why I remember that. I remember it was a big deal because they were really the top two amateurs in the world, but the seeding came out. One was I think Joel was medalist and JJ got in on a playoff, so he was the 64 seed. And so it was one of those kind of like you just talked about with JT Higgins on the podcast. You know, it was that Georgia Oklahoma State showdown in the first round. Sometimes the top two teams unfortunately meet in the first round instead of the final.
They do. It happens, and that's, I guess, the way it is. But I didn't even realize we had a Kicking Bird connection. I'm sure I saw you. I probably sold you a bucket of range balls or a green fee or something at that point in time. But anyway, I didn't know we'd run across each other later. I remember when you first arrived on the scene. I had become sort of the new head men's golf coach at Oklahoma State, and you were getting into the golf journalism world. But to take me through, because I'm a hard copy guy. Mikkel, our associate head coach, will tell you I still do a lot of things hard copy. When I wrote that book 6 or 7 years ago, it was very intentional. There was no online version of it or digital format. It was a hardcover, the first three editions with a dust jacket. I'm a hard copy guy. And I miss the days of truly having golf magazines. There's still a few around, but not many. But talk about the history just in the 18 years you've been in.
Yeah, I mean, it's changed a lot. I think there's always that famous quote. I think that the smaller the ball, the more interesting the writing. I want to say that was from George Plimpton, who is a famous sports writer. And but even when I started January 2nd, 2006 was my first day at Golf Week. I'd worked at a couple small newspapers before then, and then kind of came on as a assistant editor at Golf Week, which kind of meant you helped compile the scoreboard section. Which is probably part of why I know so many random amateur golf results and such, because I mean, literally every Sunday night, you were formatting all those scores. These go in the back of that magazine. I mean, it was pages and pages of. I remember Patrick Rogers dominating the FCWT and just things like that, and random. I mean, you were doing state AMs, state mid AMs, city championships. I think sometimes would make their way in there for the bigger cities and. Doing that, covering some junior golf. The first event I ever covered for Golf Week was the 2006 FootJoy in Greensboro. I don't remember. Andrew Yoon won. I think he was about 15 years old. I remember meeting Ricky Fowler and talking to Alan Bratton about him, I think. I want to say Alan was out there recruiting him.
Yeah, Alan was there. I was, I think, running golf camp during that same
Okay.
week.
Yep. And I remember running into Ricky and his mom Lynn in the airport leaving Greensboro. So I was covering some junior golf, amateur golf, and then doing that, putting stories on the website, putting together the scoreboard section, and you know, writing for Golf Week was a weekly magazine back then. So it was probably 45 episodes or issues. I don't think we did every week, but most of them. And you know, ever since then, I think things have mostly gone online. You know, we've talked a little bit about it. There's less. I mean, when I was covering, probably I was covering only amateur golf, probably from 06 to about 08. I covered my first major was the 08 US Open. I had to leave on the 15th hole of the playoff, so I didn't see one of the great endings. Yeah,
Oh my gosh.
I had a flight to Alaska. I was going to Alaska with a buddy, and we had about five people there, and they said, "You just go, we'll handle it from here." And so I missed one of the great endings in golf history. But I mean, we would go to junior events. I mean, I went to Colorado for a. I think a Rolex Girls. I went to Orlando for when Ricky won at Bay Hill for the, you know, HP Boys. We went to a US Junior at Rancho Santa Fe. Philip Francis, during his glory years of that junior golf year where he won everything. I mean, we'd travel all over. But I think, like you and I have talked about, you know, covering golf is so expensive. And I think you look at the history of before there was video, you really had to go somewhere to cover it. So, you know, when Bobby Jones is playing the British Amateur, if you don't have a writer there who's witnessing it, there's no other way for anyone to know what happened. There's no television. There's no, but now as more things are on video, you know, I have PGA Tour Live here on in the corner, people can cover more from home. And so, you know, companies to save money will have people cover more things from home. We do it at pjtour.com sometimes, to be honest, just because of the sheer expense of covering, you know, every tournament that we run, which are so many between all of our tours. And so you have less of that kind of personal, I think, relationship between the players and the media. And then also, you know, every outlet looks at metrics of how many people read this story. And there are times where, you know, they know that a story rewritten off of Tiger Woods' latest tweet might get more more traffic than, let's say, a finely crafted Sam Bennett feature about the U.S. Amateur Champion. And at Golf Week, you know, the benefit of magazines, you really don't know how many, you're not as concerned with how many people are reading it, because you don't know how many people turn to page five to read this feature versus what was on page seven. You're just worried about how many people get the magazine and how many print advertisements you have, which that's another thing, is really the size of magazines based on print advertisements. And before there was the internet, print was your main, you know, way of delivering ads. I remember Golf Week magazine had classified ads in them. And I mean, all the old, you look at old Golf Weeks and it's a great trip down memory lane of like Power Built and Daiwa and PRGR and all the different companies that were making golf clubs in the mid 90s, and Golf Week and other magazines were the place to advertise. And then when the internet came, that advertisement shifted to the internet and clicks became more important. And then it shifted away from magazines. So magazines shrunk in size. So everything kind of shifted to the internet, and it's cheaper to cover things from home than it is to travel. So I think that's why you see maybe internet kind of media or golf media shift in the way that it has.
Well, you know, it's that way in every sport. I can remember when they started Monday Night Football. This is basically 1970. So you saw an early game and a late game on Sunday. That was it. You had two games on football, on professional football. I tuned in Monday night just for the halftime highlights, because they had brief highlights on every game.
Yep.
So nowadays, every game is broadcast, period. Every golf tournament's broadcast. Everything's all available to people.
Right.
So as much as it hurts me and pains me not to have a hard copy magazine in my hand like I used to, and when we watched the final five or six holes on a Sunday afternoon of a golf tournament, I couldn't wait until 5 or 6 days later to get the magazine to hear the whole story. It's like,
I mean, I'm not that old. I'm 40, but I remember the days when PGAtour.com came online and they had live scoring. And I remember the days where, you know, the Greater Milwaukee Open would be on USA. They'd go off at 6:00. And if some guy was, you know, 8 under through 11, but it was 6 p.m., they'd go off the air and you'd have to wait till the next day's newspaper to find out what he ended up shooting, whether it was a 59 or a 63. So you had to wait 12 hours to find that out. And now, you know, we know immediately what he's doing, and, you know, we can watch the streaming of, you know, how he finishes that round off, and you get the 59 alert on your phone. And I mean, that's only in the last 20, 30 years, maybe. So a lot has changed.
It has. And I'm not going to be one of those old people that says it's better in my day. It was much better. It's more nostalgic looking back at it and saying, God, that was so cool to get my magazine that had the results and a full story about the tournament we just saw. And we only saw the last 4 or 5 holes on a Sunday afternoon. That was it. But I do prefer today, actually, where you can follow a tournament in real time. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that if Tiger puts out a tweet, you get to write a story or a feature about it, and you get more hits than a magazine article could ever get.
Yeah. So, and I was so lucky to come up when I did with Golf Week, because, I mean, I went to several U.S. amateurs and U.S. Publings and U.S. juniors, and just the amount of relationship building that you get to do there. And I've been so fortunate because so many of those guys are now on tour. So, you know, I saw Justin Thomas at Bay Hill, and I interviewed him quickly for a story that I did on the back of the range at TPC Sawgrass, because it really is an amazing practice facility. And we were kind of ending the interview. He goes, man, we've come a long way since junior golf. Cause I remember he won the Jones Cup, and I just randomly asked him, like, hey, who's your teacher? And he's like, well, my dad. And of course I didn't know that at the time, and ended up writing a story on him and Mike. And of course now everyone knows that Mike is his coach. And I told Justin, I'm like, yeah, when Ricky and Jordan had kids, I just felt so old. I remember Jordan at the Jones Cup. He was in a playoff he bogeyed the last hole. I want to say he three putted and then lost in a playoff to John Peterson. And Jordan is probably 16 at the time. And he just goes, I thought I was too old to stop making these stupid mistakes. And I'm like, buddy, you're 16 years old. But he was so mad at blowing the tournament. I remember doing a photo shoot with him the day after his high school graduation. And him and Cameron McCormick were super gracious with their time, but it was a few hours. And he was tired. It had been a long day the day before. And he actually played in the Nelson the second time. He was like 3 shots off the lead, played in the final group with Keegan, who ended up winning, which tells you how close he was to the lead on Sunday. He played with the eventual winner. And then went to his high school graduation, and I think the next day, and then this photo shoot, and he's like falling asleep on a bench between shots because he was just gassed from all that. But fun memories that with some great players, really, you can't replicate anymore. But yeah, we just got to go to so many events and get to know people. I still talk to some of the players and parents that I knew from those times. And it was a great time to come up in it because, yeah, you can't replicate it and it doesn't really happen that way anymore.
No, and before we move on to current day, your current position, I want to mention one of the great golf journalists in the history of college golf and maybe the father of all college golf journalism, and that would be Ron Bilicki. Ron, they called him because he never predicted the national champion. I mean, never. If he predicted you'd win the national championship, you knew your team wasn't winning. But Ron was truly a throwback to just another day in time. And I know you got to read some of his, you probably met him and got to know him pretty well, obviously.
I worked with him for a couple of years. Yeah. I think he and I overlapped about 6 years at Golf Week. And I mean, I knew the name. I wanted to work with him. I started reading Golf Week in high school. I worked at Westlake Golf Course, which I think people listening to this probably would best know is the home of George Gankus now. When I was there, Chris Como was working in the pro shop. I was working in the cart barn, and you would get Golf Week. And again, you didn't I mean, you maybe had Golf Stat back then, but really the way to get college golf scores was Golf Week and then the Ping College Golf Guide, which I don't even know if they do anymore. But had every coach's contact info, had scores, and kind of gave you a sense of, you know, what you had to shoot to be good enough for to play for certain teams. And again, because you didn't have even, I mean, the internet to look up, you know, if I wanted to find out Mike McGraw's contact info, there wasn't like a Baylor Golf website in 1996 or seven. You looked up this book. So I'd be Golf Week, really wanted to play college golf. So I wanted to know what was going on in college, what guys were shooting, what teams were either really good or probably bad enough that I could maybe look at. and so I would read Ron Bilicki for that same reason. And so like when I met Ron, that was a huge, you know, huge deal. And he was a legend. I remember Ricky Fowler, you know, he said multiple times that when he decided to go pro that Ron Bilicki was the one who he told. And that was huge news at the time. I mean, Ricky was the number one amateur in the world, college player of the year. And he told Ron because Ron had just developed such a trust with Ricky and had been so good to Ricky in helping kind of tell his story throughout his college career. And I think really is a testament to what Ron meant to people that, you know, that was big news at the time. Ricky was the guy. And so, you know, Ricky told Ron because of their relationship.
Well, and Ron, I've got a special memory with Ron. When my dad passed away in September of 2010, we were getting ready to host the preview. I mean, just like 10 days later. And Ron came in to Stillwater and came in a few days early to do this story. And he did a fantastic job on it. And he told me before he sent the story to the Golf Week editor, he brought it into my office and said, I want you to read this first because I want it to be perfect. And he said he'd never done that in his career. He'd never given the story to the person and made sure it was just right. And I cried. It was just like the most amazing moment because, you know, he wanted it to be right for me. He thought enough of me, and I definitely thought a lot of Ron. And my wife, Pam, became really good friends through the internet or Facebook with his wife because they're both animal lovers. But after Ron passed away, I think we lost like an incredible library of knowledge for college golf. It was amazing. I love the human interest stories and the feature stories he did, which were almost always great. But here I'm going to say this in front of my listeners right now. I consider you sort of a modern day Ron Bilicki in the sense that I think you want to advance the sport. You want to accentuate all the really good things about the sport, and you do your very best to do that.
Well, that means a lot. That really does. And that's been the nice thing with PGA Tour U, frankly, is that we are more invested in the college game than ever. And that's been fun for me just because it does kind of take me back to those roots and kind of those days. And I loved covering college golf. It's so much fun. Especially, you know, those days too, those guys want to talk to the media because they're talking to the media because they did something good. First of all, right. They usually won. And then really for those kids, getting in Golf Week was a big deal. And so covering college golf was so much fun. And, you know, I got to go to Lubbock this recently to do a story on Ludwig Åberg, and I saw Greg Sands for the first time in years. It's just been fun seeing college coaches that I haven't seen in years. I mean, you and I talk occasionally, or we'll text with Robert Straub about Kicking Bird and y'all's love of ice cream. But it's good to keep in touch with the college coaches because I do just I texted JT Higgins last night after listening to your pod with him. They're good, good relationships, and just – I really do love that aspect of the game. And it is, I mean, people said before, it's a great time to see some really great players on really great golf courses. You know, if you live in the Chicago area, you can go to Olympia Fields and watch Michael Thorbjornsson, who's probably going to be on tour in a year or two, play golf. And guys like Ludvig Åberg, who've shown they can already contend on tour. So, and you can see him with no crowds and no ropes, and it really is a great aspect. And I think, too, just with the NCAAs being on Golf Channel, what that's done for the sport, too, is really cool. I think it's college golf's in such a good spot.
It's in a great spot, and it's great when you have a guy like Ludvig, who's not only one of the best players in college golf, but he's a fantastic guy. He's put together. I'm telling you, that guy's ready to go do it for sure.
I left there and I was like, man, I could learn a lot from him. Like he is so mature.
Gosh. Yeah. He's wonderful. And we've got to compete against him next month in the Big 12 championship. that's a tall order, but he's great for the college game. I think it's wonderful. You've kept those relationships going because one college coaches that you've gotten to know through the years, they're sending players your way. Mm-hmm. So the tour is still a factory, if you will, for the PGA Tour. And that's why PGA Tour University is such an amazing thing for college golf.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, when a player kind of breaks out, a lot of times the college coach is a great source of good stories about, you know, who they were before they were big and things like that. So they've helped both professionally and just personally. I just like talking golf with people, and college golf coaches love talking golf. So,
yeah, I think of you as a golf nerd. Am I right about that?
That's 100%.
100%. Well, I am too. It's just that I'm a little older golf nerd than you. I'm 23 or 4 years down the road from you. If you still have as much enthusiasm when you're my age about the history of the game, players, feature stories, all of that, and I don't know where this is going the next 23 years, but it won't resemble what you've got today. It'll be different.
Yeah, definitely. So, 100%. There's a lot going on in the world of golf right now.
Oh, my goodness. Well, thanks for all those perspectives on golf journalism. Thanks for the kind words you had about Ron Bilicki. He's one of my favorites of all times. Mm-hmm. But now I want to talk about a thread you sent out here recently, about a week ago, about Scottie Scheffler. I want to talk all about it because I sent it to my guys and told them to read it, and I wanted them to see it for a lot of different reasons, and I think you'll highlight those here in a second. But take me through that text thread. What was the genesis of it? Why did you start it? And then let's just talk about it.
Yeah. I mean, the genesis actually came from kind of personal reasons. It's just been a good first quarter. That, like we said, there's a lot going on in the game and a lot of good stuff at our work. We just redesigned our app and website. We've had some huge events with, you know, the designated events this year, with John Rahm playing so well, Max Homa, Scottie Scheffler, and then announcing the new designated events. And then the players, it's just the first quarter is such a, I mean, we come out of the holidays and we hit the gates running, or hit the ground running. And so it's just been a busy first quarter. I've got 3 young kids too, so a lot going on. Mm. And, you know, Sunday mornings are a nice time at an event to kind of, you got some space, some time, because you're not worried about the 7 a.m. tee time because those guys are, you know, tied for 65th. You're worried about the 2 o'clock tee time. So it'd been a long week. Players Week is, you know, it's the biggest tournament the tour runs. Huge week for us. And so finally Sunday had a chance to kind of take a breather and was a little bit, I don't want to say burnt out, but just needed some time to reflect and kind of, you know. And so I was kind of reflecting on Scottie and his role and how he views his job, which we all know his job and he does it very well. No one does it better right now, according to the world ranking. And Scottie and I think you have a mutual friend in Brad Payne, the president of College Golf Fellowship. And
yes,
we talk a lot about identity. And I know he talks a lot about it with the tour players, not just Scottie, and a lot with college players, because especially when you play golf, it's easy for your identity to get wrapped up in your golf score. You shoot 65, you're feeling pretty good about yourself. You're shooting 75, you're not feeling so good. You're probably pretty upset. And it's a tough way to live. It's just kind of, it's an up and down. It's a roller coaster. And so I think I was in a space where I kind of felt like maybe my work was becoming my identity or taking an outsized role in how I viewed myself, you know, how I was doing. And so just was reflecting on where identity really can be found and where Scottie finds his. And I thought, you know what? I think this makes sense. I think it's applicable for people. Obviously, it touched on Christianity and some religious aspects that some people might not want to hear about or not be turned on to. But at the same time, it's you can't tell Scottie's story or talk about who Scottie Scheffler is without touching on those topics, because it is the core of who he is. And so I just kind of talked about how it started, really, with talking about how Scottie, the impressive thing with him is the array of courses he's won on. such a well-rounded game. I mean, Augusta National and TPC Sawgrass are nothing alike. He's won at match play. He's won at stroke play. He's won at Bay Hill, which is, you know, thick, rough, narrow fairways, firm greens. He's won at Phoenix Open, which is kind of a bomber's paradise. Just such a well-rounded game. And he has the ball striking that's kind of requisite to be a successful player. I think he's second in strokes gained off the tee this season. He's led the tour in greens in regulation the past 2 years. But we saw it at Sawgrass. I think the short game, we're really starting to see how incredible Scottie Scheffler's short game is. He chipped in for eagle on Saturday. He chipped in again for birdie on Sunday to really kind of, I think, right the ship after a little bit of a rocky start where people were starting to gain on him. But the biggest thing with Scottie, why I think that he has such a well-rounded game and scrambles so well and has such a good short game is because of his mental game. And the biggest thing is that he forgets quickly. His coach, Randy Smith, said that. And he just – I think I'd compare him also to Dustin Johnson. I think they go about it a little bit differently, but just kind of see ball, hit ball. And so for Scottie, the big thing that I said was his identity isn't in his golf. And so I think when you hit a bad shot or you play poorly, you can think of yourself as I'm a bad golfer or I'm a person who hit a bad golf shot. And it sounds like a small difference, but it's actually pretty big because if you're just a person that hit a bad golf shot, well, you can quickly become a person that hit a good golf shot because you've got another one coming up in a minute. But if you're a bad golfer, then that takes longer to turn around. And a common thing that we do, a common kind of thought distortion we have is catastrophizing where it's, gosh, I'm going to make bogey. I'm going to shoot 75. I'm going to lose my card. My family's not going to have, you know, we're going to lose our house. And it's, we all can go down that negative spiral when things go poorly on the golf course or at work or anywhere in life. But with Scottie, I think because his identity is in Christ and he finds his security there and he doesn't define himself by his golf shots, he's able to be more of that type of person that, okay, I hit a bad shot. Now I can hit a good shot next. And so I think that's just so huge to who he is. And we've seen it at the Masters. We saw it when he made that great bogey save on Saturday to kind of keep control of the tournament. And then, you know, he had a 3-shot lead going into the final round and it was down to 1 shot by the time he got to the third hole. And he held that great chip shot and then kind of was off to the races and it really wasn't close. I mean, he won by 3 only because he 4-putted the last green when it didn't matter. And so I just It was words I needed to hear, and so I just want to share them with other people. And I've been really surprised by the response. I've gotten a lot of people that reached out, you know, even people that aren't Christians or aren't into, you know, religion is not something they discuss often. But I think because it's so authentic to who Scottie is, and, you know, we're all looking to understand better what makes Scottie so good because we want to understand what makes every player so good. I think people have really kind of embraced it because Scottie does a good job at making it so naturally just – explain to people why it's so important to him, who he is. And that's, yeah, I think that's why it kind of resonated with people.
Well, everything you just described is exactly why I sent it to my players, because if there's anything a college golfer almost universally struggles with, it's their self-esteem.
Yeah.
And they relate it to that golf score they shot. Mm-hmm. And as a coach, I've got to be really careful. The first time I see a kid, I never want to ask him what he shot. I never want to ask how many over par you are. It's like, that doesn't matter. We can't control it anyway.
Right.
Scottie's got an amazing, amazing ability to forget the bad, move on. It's what you try to do with every player. You mentioned the word authentic. That's the part that even a non-Christian, it should resonate with them. At least he's being who he says he is.
Yeah. And I think his Masters press conference after he won got so much traction, I think, because a winner's press conference is like the height of strength. Some guy is being celebrated for this amazing athletic achievement. So you've got a young man at the top of his game, top of his strength. And what did Scottie talk about? He talked about how he cried like a baby before the final round. And so for someone in that moment to kind of be open and honest about something that could be kind of potentially embarrassing or people might be embarrassed to share shows that Scottie doesn't need to exalt himself to feel good. And so I think in a sense, you know, Scottie doesn't take himself too seriously. He takes his work very seriously and he practices hard and he's very disciplined and diligent, but he doesn't take himself too seriously. I think in the sense of that, when he hits that bad shot, it's not catastrophic because he's like, you know what? Hey, I'm an imperfect man. in need of a savior, and that means I'm an imperfect golfer. So I'm going to hit some in the trees. I'm going to miss greens. I'm going to hit some embarrassing shots. I think so. Ultimately, I think Scotty's realization that he's imperfect, instead of trying to be perfect, takes so much stress off himself.
And it gives him an incredible freedom. I mean, incredible freedom. But I love the fact that Scotty doesn't think any more of himself, other than people will announce him as the 2022 Masters champion for the rest of his life, unless he wins several more. But he doesn't think of himself. He thought the same thing of himself on Saturday evening of Augusta as he did Monday after Augusta. It's, I'm a sinner. I need a savior. I have a savior. And there's comfort in that. And it frees him up to be a better golfer, I think.
100%. I think the people around him are great at that too. His wife, Meredith, on Sunday morning of the Masters, she told him, I'm going to love you whether or not you win this tournament or not. I think what his dad, David, said to him after he won the match play to become number one in the world tells a lot. He said, I'm so proud of the man you've become. It wasn't, I'm so proud that you've become number one in the world, because behind that statement is then, okay, well, if I become number two, are you less proud of me? But when you say I'm proud of you for who you are, then that doesn't change. And then there's security there, and it's not based on results. So I think those, he has great people around him too, which helps a lot as well.
Wouldn't you hate to have your self-esteem be based upon your golf score? I mean, and yet kids get trapped in that I coach, and kids on every college golf team in the country. And if they're listening to what Scotty is saying, and by the way, he was a great college player at the University of Texas. He was a great junior player. I watched him grow up, recruited him and, you know, several other kids, including Will Zalatoris and Connor Black, in that same class in Texas. And when I was at Oklahoma State, and he was a wonderful player at every level, but he's always been a unique player. Mm-hmm. And I think now that he's had so much success, like, think about what he's done the last 20 months or so. It's like Tiger-esque. It's crazy how well he's played. But one of the terms too that you used in this thread was acceptance. And I think that's one of the hardest things for a college golfer to do. Talk about it.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons it's hard for us is because I think we're afraid if we are accepting that we'll become indifferent. That if we don't get angry or upset, that we don't care. And Scotty does a good job, and Brad Payne does a good job explaining this, and Scotty lives it out of, you still work hard, you still prepare hard, you still train hard, and you can even be upset with the results. You know, I thought Scotty in his press conference after the Players talked about the Tour Championship, where he lost a 6-shot lead on the final day. And, you know, you're really looking to finish that off, win the Tour Championship, cap off an amazing year, where you've won your first major, you've won 4 times, you're player of the year, and you want to just cap it off with this perfect finish of winning the FedEx Cup, winning the last round of the day or last round of the season. And instead, he lost a 6-shot lead, which is ties for the largest in tour history. And he admitted that he was sad, and that made him sad for a while. So I think we're afraid to be accepting because we think we will maybe become these emotionless robots and not care enough. And we think getting angry shows that we care. But you can do all the work you can, prepare as well as you can, but then at some point, I think, let go of the results. And so there's anger versus acceptance. And, you know, you hit a bad shot, you can get angry about it. Why did I do that? How did I hit it there? What am I doing? Et cetera. Or you can accept it and say, okay, I've just hit this shot here. I'm not happy about it, but my ball's there. And no matter how angry I get, that ball's not moving from behind that tree. Mm-hmm. So as I'm walking to my ball, I can just, you know, maybe take a moment and say, I wish I hadn't hit it there. I'm upset at myself that I hit it there, but I got to get this ball forward and get this ball in the hole. And by the time I get to my shot, say, okay, this is where my ball is. Let's make the best of the situation. You know, you've made the mistake. Don't make it worse and compound it by keep getting angry. Just now you've made the mistake, but make the most of the next situation.
When I've walked with players through the years and the kid's really, really upset, and coach, you don't understand how mad I am. Well, no, I kind of have an idea. I've got an idea. But are you mad enough to do something about it? Mm-hmm. Are you that mad? Because if you're not mad enough to do something about it, and all you're going to stay is wallowing in the mire of that anger, you're going to hit another bad shot. And Mike Holder taught me one thing one time. He said, you know why kids get really, really upset? And I said, why? And he said, because they know they're going to do it again. And that's what they're really upset about. And it's, they haven't accepted that I just hit a bad golf shot and move on. Tiger kind of confused people because he would get so angry after a bad shot, but he did it to release it so he could hit the next shot. I never saw him hit two angry shots in a, or two bad shots in a row because of anger.
Yeah.
So anyway, Scotty's incredible at acceptance. I know Randy Smith's helped him with that too. And I know Brad Payne has, but all good stuff right there. What else from that thread do I'm looking for some other stuff. Oh, his faith is not a means to an end. You wrote, it's like, he doesn't have faith so he can be a better golfer.
Talk about. Yeah. His faith makes him a better golfer, but I think, you know, some people might say, oh, Christianity is a crutch, or, you know, he's using it as a way to play better golf. But that's not the case. He's a Christian because he believes that Christ died for his sins. He's a Christian because that's his belief. It happens to help him play better golf. And I think there's a big difference there. If you're just using faith to get what you want, then your faith, you probably should question your faith. And so I think, instead, it's, you know, Scotty didn't become a Christian because he wanted to play better golf.
No.
Scotty became a Christian because he knew he was a sinner. So.
And he plays better golf because of that faith, probably.
Yep.
You know, some coaches have told me, well, I hate it when a kid on my team, you know, comes to faith, because then golf becomes way more important. Or, I mean, his faith becomes way more important than the golf, and their golf suffers and whatever. And I said, no, I don't think that has to happen. Sit the kid down and talk to him. So Christianity, your faith is the most important thing in the world to you. Yes, sir, it is. Well, think about Christ. He was a carpenter, correct? That was his vocation. And it doesn't talk about it in the Bible, but for a fact, his character is revealed in the New Testament. It's very well documented, his character. So that tells me he was a carpenter who showed up on time, who did great work, who charged a fair price, who was kind to the people that he worked for. However he did that, that's what you do as a student athlete, as a Christian student athlete. You do the best job you can for your teammates and for your coaches and for your university.
Yep. And you realize you were given certain gifts and you work to maximize those gifts. I think the difference is, it's, you know, you work hard to maximize those gifts, let's say, but with the difference is after your practice session. Okay. You decide, you know, I need to spend this amount of time today working on my game, and I need to work on these areas. I'm gonna do it for 3 hours. But then when those 3 hours are up, you move on to whatever other part of your life, whether it's your studies, whether it's your family, whether it's your church. You're not consumed the other 21 hours that day by your golf. You put your golf in its place, you do what you need to do, and then you move on to the next aspect, and don't spend, you know, the other 18 hours, you know, making air swings while people are trying to talk to you, or, you know, thinking about your lag in the middle of a sermon, or, you know, thinking about putting while you're studying, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's the fact that a tour player has a wife, he has children, he's got business engaged, he's got all kinds of other things that have nothing to do with that putting stroke. So he goes and works on it, gets it accomplished, and moves on to the rest of his life, whatever that is. You even in your world, with what you do, you've been obsessed with your job at times. Talk about that, because I know I have as a golf coach.
100%. And I think, especially being in, like, a, you know, we talk about the news and media and how it's changed. You know, at one point, a newspaper or magazine, at some point you've got to print it. So you submit your stories, and that thing goes to printing press and it's gone, which you can't change anything, which is horrifying at times, because if you misspelled something, it's staying there. But also, you can't, you know, you wrote that story, you might not like the way it turned out, but it's gone. You can't do anything about it. Whereas the internet, if I wrote something that I didn't like, I can get in the back end of the system and I can kind of change it, and I can print it or publish it, and it'll be changed right away. So even if I spelled your name wrong, I could fix that right away, and boom, it's fixed. I could keep fiddling with stories until I felt like they were perfect. And at the same time, like, if news happens at, you know, 7:30 p.m., you know, I've got to hop on and, you know, like, leave dinner, let's say, or leave bath time or bedtime, and go handle that at times. And so, because, whereas in a newspaper, it's like, hey, we can't do anything right now. Deadline's passed. The newspaper's out. We'll handle it tomorrow. So, I mean, there's great freedom. I'm glad that I can edit stories I don't like. But at the same time, there can be an always on kind of mentality, because you never know when the next thing is going to happen, when something might happen at 7:30 p.m. or, you know, or at 6 a.m. And it can be hard to get away from work for those reasons. And so I think, yeah, that's somewhere where I've had to, you know, kind of set boundaries and say, I'm going to work from these times, and maybe put some protocols in place where if something happens at 7:30, how do we handle it, or who handles it? But it can be all consuming because it's a 24/7 news environment now.
It is. So in our world, coaching, relationships kind of end up being the most important thing. I mean, relationships with other coaches, definitely relationships with your current players, former players. So how is that in your world? Because you've developed relationships with colleagues, but also with athletes that are playing the game at the highest level. How important are relationships to you in your job?
Yeah, I think they're everything. I think, and now managing a little bit more, in some ways, it's kind of like parenting, I feel like. But you're trying to help people grow. And I think you're trying to help them. It's been a good balance too, learning that you can't control someone else's behavior. You can maybe influence it and you can dispel wisdom, but what they do with that is out of your hands and up to them, which probably maybe took me longer to realize than it should have. But that's been a good thing that I feel like I've learned more of recently, is just how, in general, how little control we have. Even I did another podcast about Scotty, and we talked about a study they did with the Iron Byron, and I think it was hitting 7-iron shots or 6-irons, and a 5-mile-an-hour gust of wind had about a 10-yard impact on the golf shot. And so, you know, you look at that in golf, you can prepare all you want. You can execute your swing perfectly. You can strike the ball perfectly. But if a 5-mile-an-hour gust of wind comes up and it blows your ball 10 yards offline, all of a sudden your perfectly executed shots in a bunker or in water. And talking about acceptance is you can get angry about that. But there's nothing you could have done. You can't control the wind. And, same thing, I think with work, in my sense of, it's about preparation. It's about doing what you can control. And then in some sense, you have to just let the rest go.
These are all good lessons for college golfers, for junior golfers, for CEOs, doesn't matter. This is all good stuff. I appreciate it. So what is Scotty's best quality? If we could finish your thread here, what do you think his best quality is outside of, I know you're a Christian, I'm a Christian, we know that that's a great thing in our lives, but other than that, what's his best quality?
I think it is that forgetting quickly. I mean, at the end of the day, well, and a couple of things. I think credit to Randy Smith for not changing his golf swing.
Mm-hmm.
I think how easy would it have been for, you know, some 7-year-old kid to show up at your driving range and he's hitting it good, but you're looking at that right foot and you're like, this ain't going to work. So credit to him, credit to Randy, I think too, for kind of having an old school coaching, let's say philosophy, encouraging guys to shape shots. You know, watching Scotty go through a warm-up routine is pretty telling. I mean, he's hitting a high, he's hitting a low, he's hitting draws, hitting fades, he's working it all over. And I don't think you need to always be working it. I would probably lean more towards, especially the non, you know, top elite tour player relying on one ball flight for consistency. The game's hard enough as it is. Why add more variables? But I think all of those work really well. The forgetting quickly, and I think then the scrambling, you know, there's a lot of great ball strikers on tour. And it's similar to Tiger. I'm not comparing Scotty to Tiger, though maybe his last year you could. But Tiger was a great ball striker, but his short game was amazing. Mm. So when he did get in trouble, he could get out of it. And I think Scotty has a very similar kind of skill set where he's a great ball striker, but when he's in trouble, he can get out of it.
Yeah, and I think I agree with you. His scrambling, he's always in the game. He's never out of a hole. And his ability to forget the bad stuff and move on as quickly as possible. I'm hoping, as good a guy as he is, I'm hoping he's good for a very, very long time, because it'll be great for the game of golf.
Yeah, he plays imperfect golf really well. I mean, I think we see some guys kind of fire on all cylinders and dominate, and they look like they're playing perfectly. I think even in Scotty's kind of, you know, he won by 5 last week at the Players. But I don't think, you know, it wasn't perfect golf. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Hogan in his prime, let's say, robotic golf. There were misses there and there were recoveries, and but he won by 5. I think he didn't have the catastrophic miss that's so easy to have at TPC Sawgrass. Him and Ted Scott have such a good game plan, and his ball swing is good enough that he was able to definitely avoid the catastrophic miss, which, you know, undermines so many people in that tournament. But then when he did get out of position, he also didn't compound the mistake and didn't let, you know, it's easy to do that at TPC Sawgrass too. It's designed to do that. Once you get yourself in trouble, you can get yourself in more trouble real quick. And he didn't do that either. And so I think those are all traits that I admire. But even, I mean, he has to have such a well-rounded game to win the Masters, contend at the US Open, win the Players. I mean, so many different kinds of golf courses that demand so many different kinds of shots.
Yeah, he's a good one for sure. Well, so we're going to ask each other a trivia question here, because we're both golf nerds. I prepared one on Tiger Woods. may or may not be a really tough one. I don't know. And you've prepared one on Ben Hogan for me. Before we do that, and before we finish this, I'm going to ask this question. Did you ever dream this reality that you're in living right now would ever happen? When you were in 2004, did you dream this?
Yeah. You know, I've got to remind myself that, like when I get stressed out about work, let's say that if you had told, like 2004 me or college me that like, this is what I'm doing, I think then, and said that, oh yeah, now I'm stressed about it or, you know, upset about something, they'd be like, what are you thinking? I always wanted to be a golf writer. I started playing golf when I was about 12. We moved to California and I got in at that Westlake golf course. It's a 5,000 yard course, but it's got an amazing junior program. And it's a great course for kids to grow up on. Cause I mean, we had like 11-year-olds playing against 15-year-olds and you could all kind of compete cause it's not that long. Chris Zambri, actually, I think I want to say Chris gave me my first golf lesson because he was on what was then the because back then it would have been buy.com maybe. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It wasn't the Hogan Tour. It might have still been the Nike Tour actually. But Chris was on that and it didn't pay nearly as well as it does now. It's maybe and so on weeks off he would teach the group lessons at the junior camp. And Chris is a guy who's obsessed with the golf swing. And that was a fun thing too. I think a lot of my golf history stuff is about the golf swing and kind of different theories and how the teaching on the golf swing and ideas in the golf swing have evolved over time, just because I grew up around Chris Como and Chris Zambri. And there was a guy there that taught Ted Lehman. He played 1 year on tour as well. And actually he was teammates with Bobby Clampett and he said that ruined him. He went to BYU and saw Bobby Clampett and he's like, I don't know if he tried the golfing machine, but he's like, I got to become a different kind of player to hang with. If Bobby Clampett's what the standard I have to hold myself to, then I'm in trouble. And this is a guy who's beaten Corey Pavin, like in the high school conference tournaments back in California. But anyways, I got off track, but I think I always wanted to be a golf writer in part two, because I knew there were fewer people wanting to be golf writers than wanting to be, let's say, baseball or football writers. So maybe a little pragmatic, but I've loved golf. I've loved the game. I've been obsessed with it since I was probably 12 years old. And so it really is a dream come true.
I've got an affinity for golf nerds. I am mm-hmm. one. So anytime I run into one, you know, and I've noticed your golf trivia, you're really, really good. And I think maybe you're going to be the guy to replace me because you're young. You're 25 years younger than I am. So maybe you're the next guy, but I'm going to ask you your question first about Tiger Woods. So it's not a really totally obscure. I didn't want these to be obscure. Just kind of, okay. Tiger Woods, what was his first collegiate win? What tournament?
New Mexico was his first collegiate start, right?
Yes.
I thought you said this wasn't hard. First collegiate win was the,
Sean, I'm sorry. You,
cause he didn't win.
He won that week.
He did win that week. Ah,
yes. Yeah. And I believe he did. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Somebody correct me. I believe he won that week. So anyway, he won. He and Patrick Rogers and Maverick McNealy all are tied with most victories.
So Tiger, no offense to Maverick or Patrick, but Tiger did it only 2 years.
He did. He really did. Go ahead.
I tweeted one thing out that it did pretty well. It was – so Tiger won, I want to say, 8 times in the 95-96 season.
He did.
And his scoring average was 70.6. And I was looking at Golfstat, and a 70.6 scoring average would have been like 75th in the country that season 2 years ago or so when I tweeted it.
Well, I remember that tweet, and I know that we're having all this controversy on the golf ball and dialing it back and all of that currently. And I promise you, the golf ball Tiger used and the club and the equipment he was using, week in and week out, you shouldn't shoot as low with those clubs and balls.
Right. No.
Yeah. No, no doubt about it. Okay. So there, maybe somebody will correct me. I'm pretty sure I'm correct about that. What is your Ben Hogan question for me?
Who was runner up to Ben Hogan in his first major victory and how many strokes back did he finish?
Well, okay. I'm going to go. His first major victory was actually the PGA Championship at Match Play in 1946 in Portland.
It was a trick question because it was a match play.
Okay. So that was his runner up.
Can you name the runner up?
I can't. I don't know who he beat. Who did
he beat? It's one of the great nicknames in the history of golf.
Ed Porky Oliver?
Yep. There we go.
Okay. All right. Well, and if you were going to go with his first stroke play major that he won, it would be the 1948 at Riviera U.S. Open, where Jimmy DeMeritt set the U.S. Open record at 278. 45 minutes later, Hogan bettered it at 276. And that record lasted until 1967 at Baltusrol when Jack Nicklaus scored a 271. So anyway, 272.
One of the great lines from a golf, speaking of golf journalists and golf media, one of the great lines in golf media history was when Bob Drum was eating lunch with Arnold Palmer between the final two rounds of the U.S. Open. When Arnold goes, well, if I shoot 65, I shoot 280. 280 always wins the U.S. Open. And Dan Jenkins goes, when Hogan shoots it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's no doubt when Hogan shoots it. But, okay, well, I don't know if we stumped each other. You sort of stumped me, but I did get the nickname Ed Porky Oliver. Great player, by the way. Well, Sean, thank you so much for spending an hour with me here today. I love what you do. I follow you all the time, and you're doing a fantastic job for the PGA Tour and for the game of golf.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you, Mike. And how are things in Waco? What's the outlook for the Bears real quick?
They're good. We're getting better. I feel like the team is improving week by week by week. We're playing a pretty tough schedule, and we still have the meat of our schedule. We have the Aggie Invitational, immediately followed by the Arizona State's tournament, and then the conference championship. We all know the Big 12 conference will be tough at Perry Dunes. But so those are our next three events. We got a little time to prepare for those, but we're pretty excited about a good year.
Nice.
All right. Well, thanks again, and I'll keep following.
Sounds good. Thanks, Mike.